This is The Record. I'm Ross Reynolds. With income inequality on the rise, many are asking if the American dream of equal opportunity is gone. One of those people is Hedrick Smith. He shared a Pulitzer Prize for the Pentagon Papers and won a second Pulitzer for his reporting from Russia. Hedrick Smith's bestsellers, The Russians and The Power Game, are used in many college courses. His most recent book is Who Stole the American Dream? It's now out in paperback. Seattle Times business columnist John Talton wrote, "No book goes to the headwaters of the middle class decline with such precision, detail, and accessibility." Hedrick Smith joins me. Thank you so much for being here.
Ross, real pleasure. I hear you often, so it's nice to be with you.
Tell me, first of all, how do you define the American dream?
Well, I think I define it the way a lot of middle-class Americans did. It's not the Horatio Alger dream from the bottom to the top. It's not the immigrant's dream come from abroad to come here. But it's the dream of middle-class people to have a steady job, rising income throughout their lifetime, not maybe dramatically, but you've got more skills, you've got more experience, so you do a bit better. You get a health benefit, you get a retirement benefit. You get enough pay to be able to put the down payment down on your house, and with 30 years of payments, you own it when the time you retire comes around, and so you've got some security in retirement, and you hope your kids are going to do better. That's what's in jeopardy, I think, today.
And as you describe in this history, we kind of had that dream from the 1940s right up until the 1970s. Some people date to the change in equality back to the Reagan era or back to the Bush era. You go back much further.
You know, it's interesting, Ross. I was head of the New York Times Washington Bureau in the late 1970s when Jimmy Carter was president and when the Democrats were in control of both houses of Congress. And I had thought that the real bend point in American history was the election of Ronald Reagan, the Republicans taking over the Senate for the first time in 26 years in 1981. But when I got into doing the research for Who Stole the American Dream, I actually discovered that it actually started and the change had come on my watch. We saw Jimmy Carter get beaten on a whole bunch of things. We saw labor lose some legislation it wanted to get, hoped to get. But we really didn't know why this was going on. And as I began to dig into it, I discovered that there was a kind of a revolt of the bosses, a revolt of the business leaders, triggered by a memo written by Lewis Powell.
Of all people.
Of all people. A mild-mannered, Tidewater Virginian, soft drawl, but ardent advocate of the free enterprise system and ardent enemy of organized labor. And the consumer movement, and the women's movement, and the environmental movement, all of which had been powerful and had been affecting policy through the 60s and the 70s, making gains for the middle class, but as Powell saw it, setting back business. So he wrote this memo, and he said, "Business, you're getting killed in the political arena. Get active, get involved, and go after your enemies aggressively, pool your resources, think money, have a long-term plan, think here we are today." So he did a number of things that were very prophetic. There were only 175 companies that had offices in Washington to lobby the government when Powell wrote his memo. 8 years later, there were 2,425. There were 50,000 people working for business trade associations. There were 9,000 registered corporate lobbyists. The National Association of Manufacturers had moved its headquarters to Washington. The Chamber of Commerce had tripled its budget, doubled its staff. The Business Roundtable, which is the organ of the most powerful blue-chip companies in America, formed 4 months after Powell wrote his memo. So that was a real trigger. And what happened was business moved in forcefully, lobbied effectively. They got the 401k plan. They got a change in the corporate bankruptcy laws, which had tremendous impact on the bankruptcies in the 90s and the 2000s. So a lot happened in that 1978 Congress.
And we should point out what you see as the significance of the 401k plan, which is common for most employees today. But it's a big shift from the 40s through the 70s when most people who retired got a defined benefit program. And of course, this is one of the big issues that we're talking about today in wake of the Boeing machinists voting down a contract extension being offered by Boeing. And one of the reasons they voted that down is because it would have shifted their pension plans over to a 401k plan. And it sounds as though this is part of labor trying to rise up against what you would say would be the enforced inequality brought on by this shift in pension plans.
Yeah, I think the Boeing thing is a piece with Who Stole the American Dream. You ought to know that the 401k plan has caused the shift of costs of hundreds of billions of dollars a year from the corporate books to the pocketbooks and the checkbooks of ordinary people. That, in my opinion, is part of the theft of the dream. In 1980, 84% of the people who worked for companies like Boeing, companies that had more than 100 employees, had lifetime pension plans. That right. meant you got a monthly check from your former employer from the day you retired till the day you died.
But of course, businesses have said, we need to change this because we're not competitive on the global plane. These costs of these health plans and retirement plans are really dragging us down. We can't be competitive internationally unless we get these concessions.
Well, if that's the case, then how come Germany has an export surplus and we have an export deficit and they provide the benefits that American companies say they can't provide? I don't buy that argument. In fact, there are other countries that took a different fork in the road, and their international companies, Bayer, Airbus, is doing just fine, thank you very much, paying the benefits that Boeing says it can't pay to be competitive. This is not to say there don't have to be some adjustments. Maybe there were retirements that were set up where people would retire at 55 after 35 years of work if they went to work at 20. And with longer lifespans, you have to have retirement coming later. But you can't make the argument when you look at the global picture and you look at other countries that this can't be done. You know, and the 401k has been a disaster. The median 401k balance among people in their 60s on the verge of retirement is $85,000. That's enough to last people about 5 years. And life expectancy for most people is 17 years or more. It's nowhere near enough. So the company's saying, I can't afford it. Do you think people can afford it? Individuals can afford it if the company can't?
I'm talking to Hedrick Smith. His book is called Who Stole the American Dream? And it's a history of this going back to the 70s. It details a lot of things that we've been reporting on for many, many years, the change in the people who have the money in this country and the move towards more wealthy people. One of the things you talk about as a key to renewal of the middle class is creating a sort of uprising of people. We've seen a little bit of that with the Tea Party movement, which has been extremely influential in Congress. Where do you see a grassroots movement having what you would probably call a more progressive, appropriate approach?
Well, I think part of what I would say, first of all, is there are a lot of economic things we can do. People in Seattle probably don't want to admit it, but Seattle is not one of the most modern ports in the world, nor is San Francisco, nor is Long Beach, nor is New Orleans. We need to modernize our ports, our airports, our railways, and so forth. We need to invest in the future of America to be more competitive globally. Back to this issue about whether or not we can compete. And in order to do that, we need to enact some economic measures. You can't get a thing through Congress the way it's set up today. Because of gerrymandering, because of safe districts set up by both Democrats and Republicans, about 90% of the congressional seats in the House are non-competitive. So if you're unhappy with your current congressman or congresswoman, or you're unhappy with Washington, there's not much you can do about it in 90% of the districts in America. So my answer to that is, if we want to change things, we are going to have to get engaged ourselves. And actually, as you point out, Ross, the Tea Party movement is an outgrowth of public dissatisfaction. It started out with anger at the banks, and then it shifted into anger at government. And the Tea Party's been pretty effective. On the other side, you had Occupy Wall Street. It was not as well organized. It was not as clear in articulating its goals. So it didn't succeed except to say, we now can say the 99% and the 1%. But what we need to see now is some focus on political issues.
A populist renaissance is what we need. But is populism possible in the age of astroturf grassroots groups, in the age of digital media that allows corporations to leapfrog over the news media, in an age where the Tea Party, arguably a grassroots movement, kind of became co-opted in many ways by large businesses?
I think part of it has to do with whether or not people are angry enough. I mean, what's interesting to me about the Boeing vote by the machinists is this is a popular reaction against the leadership of the union, against the political leadership of the state, and certainly against Boeing. Ordinary people, ordinary workers, by a 2-to-1 margin roughly, are saying, hey, look, what you want to impose on us is stealing more of the American dream, and we're not going to go along with it. Now, next question, do you have a strategy? Are you risking losing 50,000 jobs for the state of Washington? That may be true, but what's saying something to me is I think people are starting to get desperate. You see these flash strikes by fast food workers. They're making $7.25 an hour on a 30-hour week. That comes out to $11,000 a year. That's poverty wages. People are saying, we can't do this anymore. They don't have a strategy. They don't have an economic answer, but they are telling you this isn't going to work. I mean, Citigroup, just the liberal economists, but Citigroup says this is the greatest inequality in America today of any major economy since 16th century Spain. Ross, that's 500 years.
Finally, Hedrick Smith, as we look at the history, the heyday of the middle class, perhaps the 1940s into the 1970s, could it be that that is the anomaly in American history and that what we're seeing now with greater inequality is the norm in American history.
Well, it's certainly a pattern of American history to alternate between two eras like that. We had a great era of the great robber baron wealth in the late 1880s and 1890s. And by the way, at the same time we had great wealth, we had the Long Depression. Most Americans don't remember that, the financial panic of 1893 and the Long Depression. Then we had greater equality. It came up with Teddy Roosevelt and Woodrow Wilson in the Progressive Era in the turn of the early 20th century. Then we went back to great inequality again with the 1920s. And it led to what? Black Friday, the stock market crash, the Long Depression of the 1930s. And then we went back to an equality era. Here we're now into an inequality era. So we go back and forth and we pay a price. We haven't learned the lesson of our own history.
We've just scratched the surface of this wonderful history of what's been going on with the American middle class. It's called Who Stole the American Dream? Hedrick Smith is the author. He's going to be speaking at the University of Washington Tacoma this evening at 6 p.m. and also Monday at Seattle University at 5:30 p.m. Thank you so much for stopping by.
Ross, a pleasure to be with you after hearing you so much. Thanks.
This is The Record.